Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, June 2nd, 2014. Ben Roland with some music from Morcheeba, one of my pet bands. Check them out if you never have. And Release Me Now. Well, that was the dream of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. He's been held captive in Afghanistan for nearly 5 years. And over the weekend, the Obama White House announced a 5-to-1 swap to win the release of Sergeant Bergdahl. And I fully support this. I have to say in the same breath that Obama has opened a real can of worms here. And in a midterm election year, the Republicans will ride this one to the hilt, playing on the fears of Americans about who's been held at Guantanamo and under what circumstances people should be released. And it is further complicated by the origins of the prisoner of war status of Sergeant Bergdahl. He reportedly walked away from his encampment. And so this promises to be a huge firestorm. And my big fear is that the backlash promoted by politically astute Republicans, opportunists, will lead to more restrictions on releasing people from Guantanamo and will tie the president's hands in his effort to ultimately close our gulag on the island of Cuba. And so it is with so many mixed feelings that I talk about this. Because I'm not opposed to releasing people from Guantanamo. The five men were Taliban leaders, and they were in the limbo group. They were told, you don't need a lawyer because you're never leaving here. You will never be charged, you will never be tried. And the United States, that claims to be the nation that operates under the rule of law and projects our system of justice as a standard for the world to emulate, well, all that gets lost in that whole translation and transaction. And just on Friday, I reported to you in our News and Comment a curious item in the New York Times telling us about an exchange of letters from the White House to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. The White House letter signed by Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, telling Hagel that he needs to report in every 2 weeks on the progress toward releasing prisoners at Guantanamo, laying out the standards and what the level of risk should be. The same article quoted Hagel as saying, hey, Congress made me the one who has to sign off on these, and I'm going to take my time and be extremely careful. And since Obama gave his speech last May, only 12 of 80-plus eligible for release have actually left Gitmo. Only one in the first 5 months of this year. So there is a struggle between Republican Hagel and the Democratic White House. Obama never should have put another Republican in as Secretary of Defense. To his credit, Chuck Hagel has said, related to the Bergdahl case, he's a POW. I'm glad he's coming home. We'll investigate the rest of it later. So he's not trying to score points on the Bergdahl controversy, at least not at this stage. But as I said, my fear is that they are going to figuratively weld shut the gates of Guantanamo, and not even the 72 men remaining who are cleared for release will get out. The so-called high-value detainees will be there, even if they are tried and convicted. Of course, they can't be acquitted, because our system of justice, of course, doesn't permit that. And the limbo crowd, they will remain stuck at Guantanamo, not charged, not tried, not released. And earlier today, I caught up with journalist Anand Gopal. He's a man I deeply admire. He's covered the war in Afghanistan from Afghanistan, lived there for several years, has made many trips back. He had an op-ed in Sunday's New York Times that's worth reading about the warlords that we cozied up to at the expense of developing any institutions that might survive our occupation of Afghanistan. And I asked Anand Gopal about these five men. And he confirmed that they all were high-ranking Taliban officials. But only one of the five really has the extremely ugly record on human rights and war crimes. Three of the five attempted at one point to approach the United States in order to switch sides, which goes on a lot in Afghanistan. So here's an excerpt from that conversation with journalist Anand Gopal.
Well, I would say all five are legitimately members of the Taliban, but three of the five had tried to switch sides. Only one of the five, I think, has a demonstrated record of human rights violations, which is Mullah Fazl. But, you know, the thing is that in terms of whether they pose a threat to Americans, I don't think they pose a threat to Americans. They've never launched any attacks against the U.S. They're Taliban focused on questions inside the Afghanistan.
Well, and what many of the rabid hardliners in the U.S. who want to keep Guantanamo open forever and who just assume that anybody who's there is guilty of being the worst of the worst, as Rumsfeld once described, keeping the prison open is a very bad signal to the rest of the world. It attracts enemies. And the other side of it is that holding these people indefinitely without charge or trial, under, in some cases, tortuous conditions, will radicalize individuals who otherwise might not have had any desire to hurt the United States or its interests.
Absolutely. I mean, if these people weren't a threat to the U.S. before, the one thing they could do is putting them in Guantanamo for 10 years.
The full interview with Anand Gopal covers a lot related to the war in Afghanistan, Obama's recent announcement of moving the goalposts about our withdrawal, and it'll be released later this week for subscribers at BoilingFrogsPost.com. I also want to mention that Juan Cole, the professor of international studies at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and a very prolific blogger, made a post today responding to the Republican talking points. And the Republicans say, well, you never trade hostages. You never make deals with terrorists. And that is a nice standard to try to uphold. But as Juan Cole recounts American history, he said William Howard Taft made deals with Filipinos to recover American soldiers way back in 1902, that in 1973 the U.S. used intermediaries to negotiate with the Viet Cong for release of captured U.S. soldiers. In the 1980s, Shiites in Lebanon took American hostages. The Reagan administration not only negotiated with them, but actually stole anti-aircraft munitions from Pentagon warehouses and shipped them to Iran. That, of course, the Iran side of the Iran-Contra affair. The Israelis did a prisoner swap of 1,000 Palestinians for one Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit. And so keep those points in mind when you hear the talking points of the right repeated. It's going to be a long, hot summer. And I'm really, as I say, I have such mixed feelings because I would like to see Guantanamo closed. I'd like to see an end to that despicable era of American history. And I fear that this will only protract it. The U.S. Supreme Court today decided to reject an appeal from James Risen, the New York Times reporter who's facing jail for refusing to identify a confidential source. As usual, the court's one-line order gave no reasons, but effectively sided with the government in a confrontation between what prosecutors said is an imperative to secure evidence in a national security prosecution and what journalists say is an intolerable infringement of press freedom. And you can imagine I come down on the latter side. This goes back to a subpoena that was delivered to Risen seeking information about his source for a chapter in his book from 2006 called State of War. Prosecutors say they need Risen's testimony to prove that the source was Jeffrey Sterling, a former CIA official. Risen remains resolute. He says, "I will continue to fight." And it's interesting because the original trial judge in the case, Leonie Brinkema, agreed with Risen. She said a criminal trial subpoena is not a free pass for the government to rifle through a reporter's notebook. So the Supreme Court affirmed the overturning of that original decision by two layers of appeals courts before it got the case. And this is a crucial showdown. The Obama administration claiming it's been so transparent, has cracked down on more leakers and more journalists than any administration in American history. And as we mentioned on Friday, Alan Grayson, the Democratic congressman from Florida, managed to insert and pass an amendment to the Justice Department's budget bill that explicitly precludes the Justice Department from using taxpayer money, any of its budget, to pursue journalists in a case like this. Now, as I mentioned, the Grayson Amendment is pretty broad, pretty vague, doesn't have any definitions, and to my knowledge, it's not retroactive. But it is an important statement, and a bipartisan one at that, that this is unacceptable. Now, over at the New York Times, the newly promoted executive editor, Dean Baquet, said the Supreme Court's declining this case was disappointing. And, quote, "Jim Risen is a groundbreaking national security reporter who continues to do powerful work. Journalists like Jim depend on confidential sources to get information the public needs to know. The court's failure to protect journalists' right to protect their sources is deeply troubling." And let me just remind you, this is the same Dean Baquet who spiked a story at the Los Angeles Times, where he was an editor, back around 2004, when reporters followed up on Mark Klein's whistleblowing about the NSA switch in the secret room on Folsom Street at AT&T in San Francisco. And Klein retold that story recently because of the Frontline special documentary series about the NSA. And reporters told him that it was Dean Baquet who looked over the documents and the information that Mark Klein had delivered and said, "Oh, there's no story there." Then it was Dianne Feinstein's staff who turned Mark Klein and his information into the NSA. Wow. Meanwhile, James Risen shared a byline in Sunday's New York Times with Laura Poitras, the recipient of the, along with Glenn Greenwald, of all of the Ed Snowden documents. And they confirm something that we have reported previously. And that is that the spooks in our government have managed, particularly in the last 4 years, to perfect facial recognition software. And now they are busy stockpiling images from the State Department's passport photos. And this article explicitly says that they are not accessing driver's license photos. I don't believe that. We also know that Facebook is fair game when people put pictures up. And it's one reason why the one picture that I use of myself on Facebook, I'm wearing a hat that has some message about Samoans and my sunglasses. And I just decided that, I'm sure they can find my driver's license photo, my passport photo, and I've been on television and in the media long enough that there are many pictures of me out in the public domain. But I still just don't want to cough up my own mugshot for the NSA. Maybe I should put a disguise on the picture I have on my website. Probably too late for that. So anyway, the agency intercepts millions of images per day, including about 55,000 facial recognition quality images. And that's what the data center in Bluffdale, Utah is in part for. And when it's used in criminal cases, when it's used in, investigations of international terrorism, I believe the NSA has the right to use this. But what is not clear from the New York Times article is the extent to which it's being used in the United States on Americans. And we know from the reporting of Bo Hodai, the guy who exposed the collusion between the Justice Department's Joint Terrorism Task Force, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Phoenix Police Department in rolling up the Occupy movement there, that one of the tactics, one of the systems that they used involved facial recognition of pictures that they were grabbing from Facebook. So this is just more disclosure. The extent to which we are subject to highly invasive, intrusive, and unconstitutional surveillance by our government. Meanwhile, Reddit, Imgur, I think that's how it's pronounced, Imgur, I-M-G-U-R, and Boing Boing are websites that are launching an anti-NSA surveillance campaign called Reset the Net. And they're going to be running some banner ads and trying to recruit people. The campaign is being coordinated by Fight for the Future, whose co-founder Tiffany Cheng says, "Now that we know how mass surveillance works, we know how to stop it. That's why people all over the world are going to work together to use encryption everywhere and to make it too hard for any government to conduct mass surveillance." Well, I applaud that. Also, I can only give you this tip because the information was supplied to me on what they call a press embargo. But on Wednesday, a group of activists will announce the launch of a new whistleblower organization designed to encourage people to spill secrets of our government. We'll share that with you when it is formally announced later this week. I like to pause every day and thank the people who support my work by subscribing to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Kevin Beckley, Multitask Man, Marianne Razzo, Carol Krez. Those are just some of the people who subscribe here, and I would like you to join them. Go to the aforementioned website, peterbcollins.com, and right below the aforementioned mugshot of yours truly, there's a link that says sign up. And you get to choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Best deal is our $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of this CD that I'm holding in my right hand. It's got great rock and roll tunes by John Dist. It's called Red Flag. I'll be happy to send that to you along with a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans, lovingly hand-grown by Russ Archibald and friends on the Big Island of Hawaii. Well, today is the day, after a lot of hype, that the Obama administration has announced the EPA regulation to cut carbon pollution from the nation's power plants by 30% between now and 2030, and that's 30% from the levels that were measured in 2005. And while there's going to be this big pushback from the so-called clean coal industry, we find that most public utilities, most monopolistic utilities, are going along with this. There's a real separation between the people who operate these power plants and the political operatives who support the extraction and the denial of climate change for obvious political and economic reasons. So I have no objection to what the president is doing here. He's going around the Congress. He is using his executive authority and the agency that the courts have said does have the right to regulate emissions of this sort. But the Koch brothers and their buddies are going to spend a lot of money to convince us that Obama is a coal killer, that jobs will be lost, that utility rates will go up, and that, in essence, they argue we should do nothing. But while the EPA estimates that the rule will cost up to $8.8 billion a year, it will lead to economic benefits of $55 to $93 billion over the life of the rule. Now, just on the face of it, those are wobbly statistics because they take an annual figure of just under $9 billion And then they don't list how long the life of the rule is. I guess it's till 2030. In any case, they also suggest that it will lead to a decrease of about 8% on electricity bills because it will increase energy efficiency, both at the generation stage and perhaps at the usage stage. And also, but who cares? They say that this might prevent 6,000 premature deaths every year and 150,000 asthma attacks. So, again, I fully support what the president is doing here. My only comment is that it's really pretty modest. And I credit Bob Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, who issued a statement today to remind us of this. The United States is already halfway to achieving the rule's proposed 30% reduction in carbon emissions. This reduction was achieved without a federal standard, with none of the apocalyptic effects predicted today by industry spokespeople and industry-affiliated representatives. While the economy did shrink in 2009 because of the Wall Street-induced Great Recession, it is now far larger than it was in 2005. The fact that the United States already has achieved half of the carbon reduction that EPA mandates be achieved by 2030 shows how easily this threshold can be met and how modest the EPA standard is. Well, they announced today in Palestine, in the West Bank, the organization of a new unity government, which blends Hamas and Fatah ranks. This is in response to the failure of the peace talks that John Kerry attempted to broker between Israel and the Palestinians. And I support the Palestinians in this effort because the divide and conquer strategy of Israel took effect in 2007 after Bush and the Israelis forced the election that brought Hamas to power in Gaza. We support democracy except when it produces outcomes that we find unacceptable. And since then, Israel has used every available method to punish the people of Gaza for that, to isolate Hamas. They regularly, you know, renounce them as a terrorist organization that calls for the destruction of Israel. And, of course, the reason the peace talks failed is because, despite the pleas from various parties, Israel built 14,000 illegal settlements in Palestinian land during the time that they were attempting to talk peace with the Palestinians. And those actions speak much louder than the shrill words of Benjamin Netanyahu, who is trying to round up international support to punish the Palestinians for developing a unity strategy. Now, today, for the first time, and it's been, 9, 10 days since it occurred, I'm going to talk tangentially about the mass murder spree that occurred at the University of California at Santa Barbara a week ago Friday. It is my policy not to cover these types of crimes because they're sensationalized in the corporate media. In general, I don't feel there's much that I can add to them. And in this case, I don't even think there is a clear call for gun regulation because Elliot Roger, the troubled young man who shot a manifesto video, wrote a manifesto document, he had 400 rounds of ammunition in his car, but he killed in three ways. He stabbed his roommates to death, then he used his car. I believe the car didn't actually kill anybody. It injured maybe a dozen people. And then he went to a convenience store where he fired his weapon or weapons, and at least three people did die from gunshot wounds. But this is a complex case. And I think it deserves to be studied because the alienation of young male youths like Roger, he blames women who wouldn't have sex with him for his plight, and this was his great moment to get even? Well, there are a lot of twisted thoughts there. And to thoughtfully look at what might have caused him to do this, and what enabled him to do it, I think that's worthwhile. But we have a kind of, I don't know exactly how to describe this. I think it's a very misguided but well-intended call on the parts of many people, saying that these people seek notoriety. And so the best thing we can do is to never mention Elliot Rodgers' name. Just talk about the Isla Vista killer. And that we shouldn't, going back to Columbine, mention Dylan Klebold and his buddy. And that we should never mention Jared Loeffner's name. You get the point. Well, I believe that media outlets have the right and the discretion to make decisions about whether they identify a high-profile suspect or convict in a case like this. And the public editor of the New York Times worked the issue over alongside a column by op-ed writer Ross Douthat. And both of them, you know, understand the call to not name these people. But I think for slightly different reasons, they both come to the point of view that we shouldn't have a clear and standard policy about this. Last night on 60 Minutes, they replayed a story that I hadn't seen before, and it was very powerful. It was about a school shooter who was deflected and run out of the school by a big, beefy football coach. It's a very touching story. And CBS said that at the request of parents and this teacher and others, that they were only going to use the initials TJ to describe the shooter and not name him. And again, I believe that that is well within the discretion of CBS News to make that decision. What I don't want to see is some standard that is imposed by people who are kind of do-gooders who think that this is going to prevent the next event of this type. And I do acknowledge that the media coverage and the notoriety that these people gain does feed damaged egos. But for me, the bottom line is that we don't want to put up curtains. We don't want to put up artificial filters and prevent people from accessing information. Elliot Rodgers' video statement has been pulled down, and people want to try to call back his written manifesto. I don't agree with that. Now, I think people have the right to shield themselves from this kind of information, and you can do that just by not watching TV, changing the channel, avoiding news. That can be your choice. But I don't want you to make that choice for me and say that because you're not comfortable with these people's names being used, that you want to ban it and impose your sensibilities on everyone else. And if we're going to do anything to deny notoriety to opportunistic individuals who just want media attention, then let's start with a ban on all things Kardashian. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast that you are free to share with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.